To introduce our main speaker for this evening, Jared S. from San Diego.
Thank you. I'm going to need that.
I timed myself.
Yeah, just want to make sure. Thank you. What's up, everybody? My name's Jared. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I say recovered because now I understand what alcoholism is, and I'm not suffering from that tonight. A physical craving, anytime I take one of anything, my body takes over, and I've got to have another one. You know, a mental obsession, you know, the idea or thought that just preoccupies and invades my mind that tells me, in spite of 15 years of insanity, that I can go out and have a couple drinks. You know, the thought process that takes me from the state that I'm in right now, stone cold sober, and takes me out there and says it's going to be different this time. I got this. You know, and the spiritual malady that just manifests itself in every area of my life. You know, from my bad attitude to, you know, seeking validation from outside things outside myself, depression, you know, and that state that just keeps me feeling uneasy, never satisfied, and easily annoyed all the time. But when I say recovered, please don't think that that means cured. I'll always be an alcoholic, but I can live in a recovered state from this hopeless state of mind and body that we call alcoholism. I was talking to somebody the other day about lineage. I think it's important, you know, who came before. You know, I think it's important to find out if my sponsor has a sponsor, if he's done all the work out of this book, if he's made all of his amends, if other people that he works with stay sober, and what he does in terms of service. My sponsor is a man named Nathan J. He went through this work with a woman named Tyla. Tyla went through this process with a man named Mark Houston. Mark Houston's sponsor was Don Pritz. Don Pritz's sponsor was Gary Brown. Gary Brown's sponsor was Paul Martin, and Paul Martin's sponsor was Paul Shipley. Now, Paul Shipley was the first sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous in Chicago. His sponsor was a man named Robert Smith, better known as Dr. Bob. And, of course, we all know that Bill Wilson carried the message to him. Now, I say that to let you know that the message that got delivered to me had no middle-of-the-road solution to it. A middle-of-the-road solution is anything that doesn't spell the necessary spiritual experience for me to recover from this thing called alcoholism. So I'm here tonight to share with you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today, in hopes that somebody out there is going to be thinking like I was thinking, not really sure about this thing, or that I used to do the same thing, or I used to feel the same way, or most importantly, that I too want to have this thing. So I come from a dysfunctional family. End of this month, my parents will be married 45 years. I grew up in the upper middle class suburbia of Rancho Penasquitos. My dad kept stocked liquor cabinets but rarely drank. My mom's the type of woman that would have a glass of champagne and set it down before it's halfway through because she's starting to feel it. And now, my family was dysfunctional because I was in it. And it's the truth. But I'm not here to report to you that I'm an alcoholic, because my dad kept a whole bunch of liquor at the house and rarely drank it, because somebody in here grew up with alcoholic parents. I'm not here to report to you that I'm an alcoholic because I grew up in Rancho Penasquitos and we had some money. Somebody here grew up in the hood. I'm an alcoholic for two reasons, and two reasons only. Once I start drinking, I have little control over the amount I take. And when I honestly don't want to put it in me anymore, I put it in me again anyway. I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows. That stuff does not happen to normal people. Now, from as far back as I can remember, I never felt like I fit in. I always felt separate and disconnected and never a part of. And whatever this thing was that normal people have that makes them comfortable in social situations, I just wasn't born with. You know, it was a mystery to me. So anytime I was around other people, I very quickly retreat into this prison inside myself of what I think you think about me. Now, I don't know what you think about me, but I'm stuck in what I think you think about me. Now, and I'm going to do whatever it takes to shape and form and mold your opinion of Jared. I'll do whatever it takes. Now, I remember I was 16 years old, and these people that I thought were my friends came over to call on me to do something. My parents happened to be gone this particular day. So they came in, and one of them happened to notice the liquor cabinet strategically placed by the door. And he says, "Hey, you want a drink?" And me, desperately seeking acceptance and approval, I said, yeah, let's do this. So we go in and we start taking long pulls off these bottles. I remember I grabbed a bottle, it was Knob Creek whiskey. I threw it back, I took a long pull off of it, and it burned all the way down. But right as it hit my stomach, it happened. That thing that makes me bodily and mentally different from my fellows occurred right there. Suddenly, I was comfortable standing where I was standing, doing what I was doing with the people that I was doing it with, and I never felt like that before in my life. And I started thinking, I need to get some more of this. I need to do this more often. Now, I started getting in trouble from a real young age, in and out of juvenile hall, went to my first rehab at 16 years old, and never went home after that. Ran away from that rehab, never came back home. Now, I can't tell you the month, I can't tell you the day, I can't tell you the hour where alcohol ceased to be a luxury for me and it became a necessity, but I can tell you that it did happen. Now, with this, I never wanted to follow the rules, I never wanted any responsibilities, I didn't want to work, I didn't want to pay bills, so I started, you know, a long career of criminal behavior from a real early age. Now, we talk about this disease being progressive, and, you know, after a while, I was able to drink more. That's standard, but it's progressive in another way. And my behavior gets progressively worse. So I'm more willing to do more things more readily in order to chase this thing. The Big Book talks about seeking out the lower companion, and it wasn't long before I became the lower companion. Now, I'm a thief in a lot of ways, and I'm an alcoholic, so everything that I do, I want to excel at. And so it only seemed logical to do everything I could to be the best criminal I could be. Now, the Big Book talks about not being able to tell the true from the false. And at this point, what that meant for me was I couldn't tell the difference between what alcohol was doing to me and what it was doing for me. So by this time, just a couple years later, you know, my alcoholism is in full effect. You know, I remember I used to work for a 7-Eleven. I used to steal 40s out the back. Did that one too many times, get called into the supervisor's office. And they said, "Jared, we're going to have to terminate you. You're being terminated. There's been too many discrepancies. You know, we're missing stock. There's been money missing out of the registers. And we simply do not sell 9 Mickey's 40s on a Tuesday night. It just does not happen." And, I mean, other times I remember very specifically showing up, ripping and running out there on the streets, and I show up to this house where these people who I thought were my friends were at, and I go and try and get in, and I'm told that I can't come in unless I have something for them. You know, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. It's funny, because when I remember coming into these rooms, and I heard you guys, I knew the words that you were using, but it didn't make sense to me the way that you were using them, because that wasn't how I use the words in my everyday life. You guys were talking about this psychic change and this phenomenon of craving, and I didn't understand any of that. But the first time I heard pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, I didn't need any help with that. I live pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization up close and personal almost every day of my life. Now, from the time I ran away from that first rehab in 1998, I was 16 years old, until the better part of 2007, my permanent address, as reflected on any official or court documents, was listed as transient, homeless. And, I mean, of course, I stayed here and there. I couch surfed with everybody I knew because I never wanted the party to end. And I temporarily occupied a bed in 15 different treatment facilities, you know, when it was getting hard in the street and I had to go somewhere and hide. And the whole time, I'm going in and out of jail and serving violations and new charges as the result of my drug and alcohol use. Now, I'd already talked about my behavior gets progressively worse, right? So by this time, I'm forging checks, I'm stealing cars, I'm stealing everything that's not bolted down and then coming back later for the stuff that is. Now, April 20th, 2006, my higher power came down from above and intervened in my life in his usual fashion as a shiny new pair of bracelets in the form of law enforcement. And that is my story. I always go to jail. But after a high-speed chase down the 5 into downtown in a stolen vehicle, going the wrong way down one-way streets and putting lives at risk, you know, when the handcuffs finally went on, it was like I exhaled. It's like, oh, it's finally over. And, you know, I was full of shame, I was full of guilt, I was full of remorse about the things I had done and the person that I'd become. And I didn't want to do it anymore. I was willing at that point to do something different. I emphasize willing at that point. Now, a couple days later, my court-appointed attorney showed up and he informed me that the county of San Diego deemed me unfit to remain in their custody and I started my trip to state prison. Now, I'll save you, you know, I'll spare you the details, but I will tell you that there's the possibility of real physical danger in there 100% of the time. Now, I remember waking up in the middle of the night in my cell to a scratching sound. And I sit up, and it's my cellmate sharpening a big piece of plastic on the ground because the skinheads told him that he needed to go stab somebody. And guess what? Because I'm his cellmate, I need to be the lookout. And these aren't the type of people that you tell no. Now, I finished that term, I paroled out to a program. Now, fear sobered me for a little while, and somehow I managed to put together 4.5 years of sobriety. Or, I'm sorry, that's incorrect. I managed to remain dry for 4.5 years. But I failed to enlarge my spiritual life. I didn't have a spiritual experience. I didn't work the steps. Now, the day came when it was suddenly okay to take a drink again. And because, you know, after 4.5 years, my long period of sobriety qualified me to drink like other people. And March 11th, 2011 was the last sobriety date that God gave me. Now, I got back, I was back in jail, cursing myself because I swore 100 times, I'm never coming back to this place. I'm sitting in there again. I remember looking around for, I knew the solution, right? I knew Alcoholics Anonymous was supposed to work. It kind of made my life better in the past, but I didn't really do it. I just got a little taste of it. So I went looking around for a big book in there. There were only just Spanish ones available. So I asked my girlfriend to send me another one. So she sends me a big book in there, and I remember laying in the cots in there, reading the book, falling asleep. Just, it was so boring. I didn't relate to it. It didn't make sense to me. And I didn't understand how, it's a hard read. In the 30s? Who writes like that? So, I didn't understand, right? So, I remember I got out, you know, now I'm institutionalized. You know, I can play the role, I can go through the motions to get people off my back, but, you know, so they spit me out into my 17th program, and I hear just the normal things, go to meetings and get a sponsor. Okay, well, I'll just go through the motions. So I met this man. He drove a $100,000 Mercedes. He owned a couple businesses, and he was good with the ladies. He had what I wanted. So I asked him, and he said, okay, yeah, but I gave me his number, but I never called him. I never did any of the work. And I'm so grateful that God doesn't make misery comfortable. Because I remember a couple weeks later, I went up to him, and I just hated everything that was going on in my life. You know, relationships ended, creditors found me, I hated my job, I hated my place to live, that I was living, I was broke. And I went up to him and I asked him, I said, when does it get better? And he gave me this funny look and he said, what is it? And I said, my life. When does my life get better? And he smiled and he said, well, life is going to keep happening whether you get sober or not. But if you work the steps, you will get better. And I realized at that point that I was finally out of alternatives. Big Book talks about going through slowly eliminating alternatives until you get down to two. Die an alcoholic death or live life on a spiritual basis. Now, it goes on to say that these aren't always easy alternatives to face. Now hold on a second. How is it not an easy alternative when one of the options is death? Right? Because people like us understand. Because I'm thinking, well, what kind of death are we talking about here? Is it a quick death? Is this going to be over soon? No, it's not. It's slow. It's painful. It's torturous. The kind of death where where nobody wants to see you coming. The kind of death where people aren't letting you in the house or answering the door for you, telling you you can't come in. The kind of death nobody's picking up your phone calls. The kind of death where you every day you're wondering which playground equipment you're going to sleep under because it's about to rain and you don't want to get soaked. So, you know, it's funny because it says, you know, alternatives are not easy. When are alternatives not easy? You know, it's like, why can't I just make an easy decision? Because it's not an easy alternative. Alternatives are not easy when they both look equally distasteful or they both look the same. And dying an alcoholic death or living life on a spiritual basis, they look the same to me. They look the same. I think living life on a spiritual basis means no cussing, no chasing women, no fun, no doing any of the things that I like to do. And, you know, so not only do I think a spiritual basis is something that I can't, you know, that I don't want, it's something that I can't do anyway. You know, I'm not trying to be like that. And I didn't understand, but where I was, the way I was feeling, I knew something had to change. So I submitted, you know? And it's like we have this spiritual illness, right? We have this illness, and here's the medicine, you know, this spiritual program of action. I'm prescribed this medicine, but, you know, I don't want to take it because that medicine looks like it doesn't taste good. That's cold, too, because only people like us are going to get that. That medicine looks like it doesn't taste. I don't know what it tastes like anyway. You know, and who takes medicine for taste anyway? You know, I don't even know what it tastes like. I think I do. So I submitted. I submitted to this thing, and I was thinking, like, I don't need to take all the suggestions. I don't need to do anything. This is kind of drastic, you know, all this stuff. I just don't want to go back to jail. I just want to stay sober, you know, or whatever it is. But so I just did what was convenient. Now, and because I took a little tiny bit of initiative, my life started to get just a little bit better. And then I stopped. Because, oh, I got a couple promises. I didn't even have to do any work. Perfect. Let's just stay right here. Now, almost 3 years later, now, I had a little job, I had the girl, I had a little bit of money, you know, I had all the things that I thought were supposed to make me happy, but I was dying inside and I didn't know what was wrong. You know, if you would ask me, how are you doing? I said, well, I'm doing great. You know, it's like I got a little job, you know, in a cool kind of industry. You know, a couple of my buddies and I started a meeting. And, you know, we're getting like 50 people a night. You know, it's like I got a little bank account. I'm doing well. But there was something. There was something that was off, that wasn't right, and I didn't know what it was. And then I went to a meeting, or got dragged to a meeting. Thank you. And it's a Big Book meeting on Wednesday night. Now, there must have been 150 people in that meeting that night. And, you know, I'm sitting there in the back, where I usually like to sit, and, you know, half measures row, and I remember that this guy standing up and coming up to the podium, and he started talking about the bedevilments, and he was talking about how he was having problems in personal relationships. Now, and I started thinking, people aren't treating me the way that I think they should be treating me. You know, how he was a prey to misery and depression, and he couldn't control his emotional nature. And I was all over the place. I was going crazy up in my head. I was trying to keep my outsides good, but I was going crazy in here. You know, how he was full of fear, how he felt useless, how he was unhappy. You know, he couldn't make a living. You know, I had a job. I was getting a paycheck, but I didn't like what I did. It was just a means to an end. You know, and he couldn't be of real use to other people. Now, at that point, I had almost 3 years sober. Nobody was asking me to sponsor them. You know, I was never getting called on meetings. And the way I felt was like all the lights went out in the room. There was a spotlight on him and a spotlight on me, and he was talking directly to me. And he went on to talk about this God-sized hole that was inside me that I'd been trying to fill with external things, money, sex, relationships, career. I kept putting all this stuff inside, and I kept feeling more empty. And I remember thinking, wait, that's wrong. I believe in God. But then I realized that my belief in God wasn't taking me far enough, that I needed access. I remember going home that night, and something was different. I remember going home, walking into my room, and I had the urge to get on my knees and pray. And I couldn't tell you the last time I had even that thought or an inkling of that. So I did it. I got down on my knees. You know, I said an honest prayer. God, please help me. I want something different with my life. What do you want me to do? And I had an experience. Now, the clouds didn't part. You know, there were no bushes on fire. Jesus didn't come walking through my bedroom. Just the absolute certainty that something was different. That I was ready. Not willing, I was ready. I was ready to do something different because I'd been willing many times in the past. And willingness only took me so far, but I was ready. I was ready to do whatever it took to do this thing. Shortly after that, I grabbed a guy to take me through this work. I grabbed this guy because he had this passion for life. And I wanted that so bad because I felt so dead inside. And so we sat down and we opened the book. And he introduced me to the circle and the triangle. He said, do you know what the symbol is? And I saw it on all the coins and everything, but I didn't really know about it. And he said, you have a three-part illness of mind, body, and spirit. So we're given a three-part solution of unity, service, and recovery. You do those three things and you experience the circle around it, which is wholeness. You do those three things, you can become a happily useful human being, whole. And we started looking at this, and he said, what do you think unity is? Now, I've been around for a while, so I said, well, I think that's the meetings. And he said, good. Do you do that? I said, yeah, I go to meetings. He said, do you have a home group? I said, a what? And he said, do you have a group that you're committed to, that holds you accountable? I said, well, no. And he said, find a group that will hold you accountable, that you go to regular meetings regularly. Go out and become known in the fellowship. Because here in San Diego, you can go, 1,058 meetings a week or a month? I mean, you can go to a different meeting every day for like 5 years and not see the same people. Except for maybe Larry Marling, wherever he is. And so if you do that, you don't get known. You go out and you drink and you die. Nobody's going to care because nobody got to know you. He said, go out and get known in the fellowship. Go to regular meetings regularly. He said, okay, well, what do you think recovery is? And I said, well, I think that's the steps, the 12 steps. And he said, good. Have you ever done that? And I start to get into how I've done 1, 2, and 3 a whole bunch of times. I've made a list of people that really pissed me off. And I made an amends to my parents once. And he smiled. And he said, let's try this a different way. He said, have you ever gone from the title page of this book to page 164 and followed all the directions? I said, no. And he said, well, you're not in recovery, and you've never been in recovery. And I was about to say something, and he said, Jared, I care about your life, not your feelings about what I'm telling you. And he told me, he said, okay, well, what do you think service is? I said, I don't know, man. After that, I said, I don't know, setting up chairs, giving people rides to meetings. He said, carrying the message. Right now, you don't have a message to carry. We're going to work on that. I said, okay. So I get, you know, because I'd been around for so long, I thought I knew something about this. And so he gave me a prayer. He said, God, Please help me set aside everything I think I know for an open mind and a new experience. Help me see the truth about the book, the 12 steps, the meetings, this fellowship, and especially you, God, so I can have this new experience. And I've used that prayer a lot because I like to think I know what's going on. And so I need to set all that stuff aside. So I started going through this work, and I found out that I'm different from normal people. You know, I remember him saying specifically, he said, don't take my word for it. You need to diagnose yourself because you're the only one who's going to be able to do it. You know, and he showed me how to read the big book. You know, I remember, I mean, I told you, I used to fall asleep reading this thing in jail. It was so boring. I didn't relate to anything. He showed me how to read it. He said, Jared, the way that you read the big book is the same way you listen to our members share their experience, strength, and hope at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. When you're reading the book, ask yourself a couple questions. Did I drink like he drank? Did I think like he thought? Did I feel like he felt? Or did I do what he did? And in light of those questions, this book came alive for me. I started to see myself all over it. Now, once I actually got to see the truth in my first step, you know, I started to become very open to something, anything greater than me solving my problem. But the problem was God was a sore subject for me. Now, I remember coming in and looking at you people, and you're all smiling, and you're happy, and you've got great jobs, and you've got cool cars and material possessions and bank accounts, and that was attractive to me. But then you opened your mouth and you started talking about God, and I said, missed me with that. I don't want anything to do with that. You know, I had unfavorable experiences with religion when I was growing up, and I didn't want anything to do with it. Because every time I heard God, I thought you guys were talking about church, and I wasn't going there with you. So, you know, I remember sitting in a meeting also early on, and I was sitting in the back where I usually sat at the time, and this guy was standing up at the podium, and it was just weird to hear somebody, to see this guy. You know, he was wearing nice clothes, he had his hair combed, he was stringing sentences together, and it was funny because what he was talking about, he didn't look like a person that could have ever done those things, and it was just weird to me. And he was talking about God, and I didn't want anything to do with that. But then he dropped something on me like this. He said, if you're sitting in this room tonight, you're not responsible for your disease, but you are responsible for your recovery. And you've just now tapped a source of power much greater than yourself. And you don't have to drink, and you don't have to use ever again, provided you're willing to fulfill a few simple conditions. And he got my attention. And the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, talks about the Wright brothers. Remember them? The people that invented the airplane, learning about that way long time ago in school. And it's funny because, you know, the whole thing behind their accomplishment of building this plane was their childhood faith that they were going to be able to build something that flies. And people told them, you can't do that. You'll never do that. God reserved that for the birds. You'll never be able to fly. And it was funny because it's the same thing with this, because they're talking about a spiritual liberation. You know, when I came in here, I started looking around and thinking, you know, this is fake. They're not really sober up in those meetings. They're not really doing that. You know, nobody can stay sober for that long. You know, they're not really coming from the dark place and now they got light in their eyes. They're not really rising above their problems. I'm not seeing what I'm seeing. I'm not stupid. So we talk about the evidence, right? How many people sitting in this room believe that the electricity's on in this room right now? How many people? What? Why do you believe that? Can you see the electricity? Oh, hold on. I heard somebody say yes. Where are my electricians at? Please tell them that you cannot see electricity. But why do you believe that, right? Because the lights. I can't see the electricity, but I can see the results, the lights. So we can do it like this, right? How many people in this room have more than 1 year of continuous sobriety? Raise your hand. Take a look around. Newcomers, the lights. The lights are on. I can't see the power, but I can see the results. the lights. This is why it makes more sense for me to believe than not to believe. So I come to the second step, you know, and, you know, really is, you know, do I now believe or am I even willing to believe that this power that I thought I believed in can restore me to sanity and take me further in every area of my life than I've ever been before. Now, so I'm willing. I'm ready. I'm ready to do this thing. So I go on to the third step, right, which is where I'm going to turn my will, which is my thinking, and my life, which is my actions, over to this power. So why am I going to do that, you know? Because I'm not doing a very good job of it where I'm at. So, you know, I do it. Right where I'm at, right then, still lying, still stealing, still cheating. I said, God, do something with me. And he did something. Put something in me before I even knew what was going on. Put something in right here. And now, so I remember next, you know, I'm making my list here, the step that everybody hates, but I'm willing. I'm really willing to do this thing now. And I like to do multiple fifth steps. If you don't have experience with that, I can't say enough good things about it. Big Book talks about when we find the person or persons with whom to share our story. I like to do multiples because I'm pretty sick. I like to see all kinds of different angles from what's going on, you know, from all kinds of different points of view. Now, the first, I did three this particular time. I got two closed mouth friends in Alcoholics Anonymous who knew me well, who I go to often, and I read them, you know, this inventory, and I just came back feeling just emotionally beat up. Like, I felt like a newcomer, like it hurt. Because I'm in my truth, and I go to them, and I start talking to them. Actually, I take it to God. The other person is only there to witness, and I get to see some truth that they're bringing to me. Now, I went through these things, and I got a lot of freedom from it. But I waited for my sponsor to be the last one, and I went. I remember I'm sitting across from him. I got my sheets. I'm reading, you know, my fears, you know, self-searching, self-seeking, you know, all kinds of stuff. The cause, why, bunch of fear. I go on to the next one. I'm reading it. He looks at me. He's all, hold on a second. And he reaches over and he grabs my sheets from me. And he starts looking through them. And he says, what you're resentful at isn't even on these sheets. I said, what are you talking about? He said, you think you're a piece of shit. Excuse me? And he said, look, it's all right here. You feel unloved and unwanted and not good enough and abandoned and rejected. This is your handwriting, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is. He said, but somebody loves you, the Father. Stop seeking validation from outside sources because you'll never get it. Seek validation from the source. Now, he said, do you believe that God loves you? I said, yeah. He said, good, start living that way. And that area of my life changed. Now, that was 6 and 7 after that were really powerful. My alone time with God, right? So we move on. And this, the word all was emphasized in the 8th step. Made a list of all and became willing to make amends to them all. Now, I get into this thing and I just start doing it. You know, I didn't know how to make amends. There was a bunch of amends I didn't want to make. And I said, well, how do I get the willingness to, you know, to make those amends? And he said, by starting to make the amends that you do want to make. So I started doing it. Now, 3 weeks ago, I made the last conscious amends that I had. Do you remember that April 20th, 2006, high-speed chase in the stolen car? Took me 11 years to find that house from a memory in the middle of the night. But I went back there. I said a prayer. I went driving around the area. I knew there was the general area of where it was because I was loaded. It was the middle of the night. I'd probably been up for a couple days. And I had this mental picture of what this house looked like. Long street, cul-de-sac house. And I drove around the area, couldn't find it. And I said a prayer. I said, God, if you really want me to make this amends, please show me how to find this person. Jumped on Google Earth, looked at a couple houses, and one of them just felt right. put it in my GPS, drove up there on the weekend, and I'm driving up. I'm like, this isn't right. This is different. This looks wrong. It's 11 years later. The landscape's changed. I pull up. I'm coming around this cul-de-sac. The house is over here. And I said, I don't think this is it. Coming around, I look, and it's like a bolt of lightning hit my body. All the hair on my body stood up, and I got chills. Because the same truck that I stole 11 years ago was sitting in that driveway. Pull up, said a quick prayer. God be with me. God guide me. What do you want me to do? Walked up, long driveway, long pathway to the door, and bushes on the sides. I'm like, geez, what if I have to run? And I walk up to it, and there's a gate, and front door past it. I try the gate, locked. My first thought was, oh, well, I tried. And I look over, and there's a doorbell right next to the gate. Ring the doorbell. A couple seconds later, the door opens. Older gentleman comes out. He's all, hey, how's it going? Can I help you? I said, yeah, I'm looking for Thomas B. And he said, well, you found him. God be with me. Guide me. Help me be present. He comes out. I said, Mr. B, my name is Jared S. I'm in recovery from alcoholism. I'm on the ninth step. I simply will not get over my drinking until I've done my utmost to clean up my past. Mr. B, I need to make an amends to you. I harmed you in the past. He gets kind of this puzzled look. I said, in 2006, I stole that truck that's sitting in your driveway. And his eyes get all big, and he says, I remember that. And then he says, I hope you weren't injured in the crash, because I crashed it. I crashed it in the high-speed chase. I said, no, sir. I said, Mr. B, my actions undoubtedly affected your life. Do you need to tell me how what I did affected you? He looked at me. He said, no. I said, Mr. B, do you need to tell me how what I did made you feel? He looked at me for a second. He said, no, I'm just trying to wrap my head around how you're standing here in front of me. Why now? Why today? And I said, well, I got a job that required me to take a hard look at my past. Your name came up on the paperwork that I have because you're one of the victims of my crimes. It was weighing on my heart, and I knew I needed to do whatever it took to attempt to make this amends. And I said, Mr. B, is there anything that I can do to make this right? And he paused for a minute, and he looked at me, and he said, you know what? It took a lot of guts for you to come up here and do this. I could have cussed you out up and down. I could have reacted in any sort of way. But you don't seem to be the type of person that would do those things today. I accept your amends, and I wish you the best on whatever life may bring you. And if you ever need any sort of a reference, you obviously have my address. Please, please, feel free to write me a letter. And I will tell whoever it is that you did indeed come by here and make this right. I said, thank you, sir. We shook hands and I left. What a trip. Nothing has had a more profound impact on my life than prayer and meditation. I can't say enough things about it. You know, there's steps in the book about how to begin the day and how to end the day. You know, can I stay aligned with God's will in the 10th step? The 10th step is full of practices. The 10th step is a lot more than taking personal inventory and admitting when I'm wrong. It's full of practices. You know, I get to start to be aware of myself. What does the 10th step say? We continue to what? Watch. For what? Selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, becoming afraid. When those things arise, I get to notice them, and I get to use another practice, turn. I get to turn out of them. I get to turn out of myself, turn to somebody that I can help. I get to turn my thoughts. I get to learn how to turn thoughts. That's what the 10th step is about. It's full of practices that I get to use on a daily basis to stay aligned with God's will. Now, I've had the benefit of walking through a lot of stuff in this program. I've had the benefit of the IRS and child support coming after me real tough for a bunch of money that I didn't have in the same week. You know, I've had the benefit of losing jobs in sobriety. I've had the benefit of a woman that I love, my significant other, screaming at me, saying, I'll never get sober. I don't want this thing. I can't do it. And you might ask, why is that a privilege? Why is that a benefit? Because I got to walk through those things and I didn't have to pick up a drink. I got to walk through those. As I walk through them, I'm armed with something that I can't get any other way. I'm armed with an experience that I can go out and help another man or woman who's going through something. Now, that the IRS problem, resolved. Child support, terminated. That woman that wouldn't do it, that couldn't do it, that couldn't get off the needle, she's here tonight, sitting front row with over 2 years of sobriety. She's a bright beacon of light of recovery in the community. She helps a lot of women. Her walk inspires me. I got a 4-year-old little boy at home who one day at a time has never seen his daddy loaded, and one day at a time he never will. You know, there's a lot of men sitting in here tonight. Now, I don't know if you guys are like me. I always had a lot of fears. You know, do I have what it takes to be a father? You know, because what's the father's role? You know, to protect and to provide, right? The way I was living my life out there, you know, that definitely was impossible. Book says, which is pretty accurate, you know, in my best moments, I produce confusion, not harmony. Let alone looking to try and care for somebody else. Now, it's funny, you know, I love that little boy with everything in me. You know, I wanted to take that little boy to SeaWorld, Legoland. You know, I wanted to walk up the street with his little hand and my big hand. You know, just take him to the store, buy him some ice cream. I wanted to sit him on my lap and read stories to him. You know, I wanted to get that look from my little boy that I see other men in this fellowship get from their kids. The look that this is my daddy and this is my hero. And you know what? Because of this fellowship, I get to do those things today. And I didn't come here for that. I came here because I'm a hopeless, helpless alcoholic, and I had no tools for recovery. You know, I'd always believed that because of my criminal history, I would never make it very far in life. You know, my options would be really limited. I believe that. You change your beliefs, you change your reality. Now, I have 7 felony convictions. I have 12 misdemeanors. I've been to state prison. Now, I applied for this job that I had absolutely no business applying for with my kind of history. And people even told me, you'll never get that. They'll never hire you with your history, with your background. It just ain't going to happen. But then there's other people like my brothers and sisters in this fellowship who said, no, you do it because God will show up. Now, I had a lot of fear. I was afraid. I disclosed everything to these people about my history. And, you know, I was afraid. But what do? You know, got to rely on God. Men of faith have courage. They trust their God. You know what courage means? Courage is defined as the ability to do something that frightens one. I got to trust, right? So I go. It took a long time. It took about a year going through these processes. I got denied twice by these people. But I got it. You know, and now I'm a direct hire federal employee for the Department of Defense. With a secret government clearance. Somebody trust me. How about that? I mean, that's what this program is about, right? We did something back then, and we still do it today, men and women in this room. God, I offer myself to thee. Build with me. Do with me whatever you want. Relieve me of the bondage of this so I can do your will. Take away my difficulties so that somebody out there who's going through something can see that God works. Can see that God works. You know, this program takes people like us, drunks and addicts and convicts and con artists and failures as kids, failures as parents, broken down pieces of men and women who don't have hopes and dreams and goals anymore. And it puts us together in one room. And I put one hand in your hand and the other hand in God's hand. And we take up our beds and we walk out of here as mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, sons, daughters, employers, employees, role models in our community. This program is about growth. This program is about change. But if there's going to be any change that goes on in my life, it begins and it ends with me. This program has given me so many blessings. If you're not sure about this thing, stay around. Just jump into it. The freedom comes to the extent that you do this thing as a way of life. So the question I'm going to leave you with is, how free do you want to be? My name is Jared. I'm an alcoholic.